This is WORT Madison, and we join BBC News.
In Egypt, after weeks of impasse, Hamas reportedly has no major issues with a revised plan approved by Israel. From Jerusalem, Wira Davis reports.
There's an increasing sense of urgency to try to reach a ceasefire in Gaza's seven-month-long conflict. And according to Antony Blinken, a ceasefire agreement is now within reach. The Israeli offer is thought to meet some of Hamas's demands over the withdrawal of Israeli troops from parts of Gaza and allowing residents to return to their home areas in the north.
Officials in central Kenya say at least 45 people have been killed after a dam collapsed during the night. The disaster followed torrential rainfalls. Barbara Platt-Usher is in the affected village of Maimahiu.
The water came crashing through the village in the middle of the night from a burst dam, basically gouging out the valley that is runs on the edges of the village, and the river overflowed its banks. So that mass of water taking so much with it, cars, trees, houses. I'm looking at an uprooted tree right now, a damaged car just a few meters away. Also people, of course, dozens of people were taken by the water and have been killed. There's still ongoing searching for bodies, as well as just people wandering around trying to get their heads around what a great disaster this has been.
African heads of state and government officials have called for rich countries to commit record contributions to help developing nations combat climate change. At a meeting in Nairobi, Kenya's president called on donors to pay at least $120 billion into the specially created low-interest World Bank facility. He cited Kenya's own devastating floods as one of the reasons for action. Scotland's First Minister Hamza Youssef has announced he's resigning after 13 months in office. He'd been facing no confidence votes after ending a partnership with the Scottish Green Party. Mr. Youssef had hoped his move would let him focus more on the economy and less on issues such as gender and the environment. He will stay on as First Minister until a new leader is found. With more, here's Rob Watson.
This is a big moment in both Scottish and British politics. The question now is whether Hamza Youssef's resignation will stop or hasten the recent decline of the pro-independent Scottish National Party. The SNP has utterly dominated Scottish politics for nearly 20 years, but polling suggests it is in retreat in the wake of the resignation of Mr. Youssef's predecessor, Nicola Sturgeon, a police investigation into party funding and closer scrutiny of its record in office.
Rob Watson reporting. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them for Revolutionary Love, an afternoon in practice with Valerie Kaur on Monday, April 29th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Monona Terrace. Valerie is a civil rights leader, filmmaker, lawyer, author, and innovator, and she will be guiding attendees of this event through the concepts of her compass of revolutionary love. This compass calls us to cultivate love for ourselves, others, and our opponents in our racial justice and collective liberation work. The afternoon will feature storytelling, guided meditations, and a musical performance by Sunny Singh. More information and registration is at ywcamadison.org. YWCA Madison invites you to join them for Revolutionary Love, an afternoon in practice with Valerie Kaur on Monday, April 29th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Monona Terrace. You are listening to WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles, services for new and used bicycles, is available on the web at budgetbicycleCTR.com.
Good morning, it is 8:06 and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. Wisconsin voters with disabilities demand better absentee voting options, and they've got a lawsuit in the works to try and make that happen. VoteBeat reporter Alexander Schur has the story. And how many photos have you uploaded to Instagram or TikTok Ever wondered what those companies actually do with all of that? Well, UW engineering researchers Kassam Fawaz and Jack West took a look under the hood of social media platforms and found out some unpleasant truths. And with Gallery Night coming up, Atwood Atelier's Philip Salamone talks about the classic art of portraiture. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer, John Wilson. All that's coming up right after this. It's 8:08. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. If you are a Wisconsin voter with a disability and find it difficult to vote in person, your options are somewhat limited. Wisconsin law requires absentee voters to use a paper ballot, which can be difficult for folks who lack fine motor control or who have visual impairments. You can ask for assistance to fill out a ballot, but then you sacrifice your right to a secret vote. A group of Wisconsin disabled voters, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and the League of Women Voters recently filed a lawsuit seeking to allow for fully electronic absentee ballots. Alexander Schuer writes for the nonprofit news outlet VoteBeat, and he joins us now with the story. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
So what these groups are asking for is the ability to vote fully electronically, to submit their ballots electronically. Is that a new idea?
It's somewhat new. It's an idea that surged after the pandemic hit. Though, if you think about like what voters with or Americans with disabilities are doing, they're frequently doing their jobs using a screen reader, for example, turning text to speech. And various other accommodations. So what they're asking for is to apply existing tools to voting. They've done that in several other states. I think 13 states currently have fully electronic voting. So Wisconsin wouldn't be the first to do it at all.
And there are some voters, like military overseas voters, that are using that in Wisconsin now, right?
So currently what they're doing is they're receiving a ballot electronically, and then they're returning the physical ballot.
I see. Okay.
So it doesn't go quite as far as what these voters with disabilities want. And of course, this current law does not apply to them.
And so are there security issues with, I mean, one of the things we've always heard is that paper ballots are secure. You can track them. You know where they are. They're harder to manipulate, you know, remotely. Are there legitimate concerns about that kind of security or hacking of fully electronic votes?
This was an interesting story to report because there's kind of two buckets of folks I talked to, and it's the election security community and then voters with disabilities, and both maintain kind of the same philosophy that security and accessibility is not a trade-off. You could have both. This was interesting because it's one of those cases where there might be a little bit of a trade-off. So there have been study groups of election professionals and then a separate report from government agencies, and what they found was if you receive a ballot electronically, that's pretty safe. If you mark it electronically, that's somewhat safe. But if you return the ballot electronically, that raises several issues. Like you said, there's no paper ballot. So verifying that ballot is hard. there's the risk that a single person could manipulate many votes. And one concern I heard from the election security community is, the argument is excellent for extending this option in an ideal world, but if, you know, dozens of votes or hundreds of votes are hacked, could that jeopardize the entire election? So that's kind of that's the question they pose. And then the response from voters with disabilities or advocates for them is security is a serious concern. They're not ignoring it, but disenfranchisement is very serious as well.
So is there a happy medium there where people can have the flexibility and the access to be able to vote whatever suits their needs and meet the security needs? What is the lawsuit actually seeking to do?
So the lawsuit is seeking electronic return, which is the idea of, electronic everything. So you receive the ballot electronically, filled out electronically, return it electronically. And some other states, they have what election security experts maintain as a happy medium, which is you receive it electronically, you fill out the ballot electronically, but then you print and return it. That is something that voters with disabilities, some say that's okay, that's a step forward. Others say you're still sacrificing the secrecy of the ballot because you often need help printing the ballot, returning the ballot. That requires a second person quite often. So that's somewhat of that happy medium. That's not what this lawsuit is seeking.
So tell us about some of the individual voters that you spoke with.
Sure. So I spoke with one voter. His name is Don Natsky. He's someone who actually, many of these other voters do not vote in person. They might be virtually impossible or close to that for them to vote in person. Don Natsky is someone who, he's a blind voter in Shorewood. He prefers to vote in person. He found that during the pandemic that was very risky to his health. So he voted absentee, or he tried to vote absentee. His wife is blind, so while Wisconsin law allows you to receive assistance from somebody, she was not someone who could read the ballot or fill it out for him. So he was explaining to me this process of talking to a remote helper using his phone that was pointing the camera at the ballot and trying to receive instructions of how to fill out the ballot. And he said it was just untenable. He didn't end up voting. So that was in April 2020. And then, so he's an example of someone, he sometimes does go to the polls, but voting absentee is difficult. And then I spoke with Stacy Ellingen, who's a 38-year-old Wisconsinite with cerebral palsy. And she cannot move on, to go to the polls. She needs someone to take her there. Her parents live quite far away. Her caregivers, there's kind of a shoddy schedule because of caregiver shortage. So she votes always absentee. And she lacks the fine motor skills to fill out a ballot, but, you know, she lives a life where, you know, she's a business owner. She accomplishes many, many other things in life, but voting is a hard, you know, particularly hard process for her. So she's someone who she just cannot possibly fill out a paper ballot herself, but, she could use a lot of these technologies she uses to run a business to, you know, fill out a ballot.
How has she voted to date?
So typically she votes by receiving assistance from, she said she prefers using her parents. They live an hour away, so they're not always available. So she might have used caregivers in the past, but basically she said it's because of the worker shortage, she doesn't want to share her, you know, political views with the few caregivers who do have time. She doesn't want to anger anyone. It seems like it's an uncomfortable process for her to share her preferences. So she receives help from her parents, and she has, you know, voted in elections, but she's also missed some elections because that lack of access.
Now, in 2011, there was some change to state law that made this even more difficult than it had been in the past. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. So Wisconsin law technically extended the right to receive ballots electronically and mark them electronically to everybody. Although when I speak with voters with disabilities, they say we never knew of this option. But in 2011, around that time, there was a federal law ensuring that overseas and military voters could vote in this accessible way electronically. Wisconsin, the legislature this was somewhat of a bipartisan law, changed this law to say only military and overseas voters could receive ballots electronically. So that kind of took an option away from voters with disabilities, but voters with disabilities say they never knew of this option. That law was later challenged in court by so-called road warriors. So they're people who are like working on the road or they may be traveling out of state. That was challenged in federal court. And the claims were different from this lawsuit, but the federal appeals court were not heavily sympathetic to these road warriors. They're saying, you know, if you're driving somewhere, you should have just kept that in mind before you were voting. So they didn't really take to the argument that their vote is sacrificed if they can vote absentee electronically. This lawsuit raises different claims and potentially a much more compelling argument that these folks' votes could actually be sacrificed.
And what is that argument, and why will it be more convincing to a court?
Well, I'm not sure if it'll be more convincing to a court, but I think it's, you know, one thing they're relying on is, or one thing they're pointing to is the Wisconsin Constitution has a right to a secret ballot, so everyone shall cast a vote secretly. They're saying that's not possible under the current accessible rules. And the crux of their issue is there's kind of a patchwork of federal and state laws making voting more accessible, but they say it sacrifices independence for accessibility. So it's giving you a lot, you know, of accessible options, but not much independence. So you need assistance for almost everything you're kind of doing there.
Now, the fact that military and overseas voters can vote electronically would seem to suggest that there's a way to do that securely. Why can't we just extend whatever we're doing for military basis to all voters?
That's somewhat of an argument here, and I think the election security counter-argument would be that this is a small group of voters and they really need this voting method, and federal law requires it. So it's not, I'm not sure if it's preference from a security standpoint, it's just something they must do. So in terms of can you extend it to another small bucket of voters, like voters with disabilities, it has worked elsewhere. There hasn't been, you know, big widespread hacks that we know about anywhere else. So could it work theoretically? For sure. Election security experts also say theoretically they could all get hacked.
So where is fully electronic voting for disabled people available?
So there's 13 states, some of the most recent ones that got it, Maine, North Carolina, those were through lawsuits. Other states have gotten this accessible voting through state law. And then there's other states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Maryland that do the kind of hybrid model of you receive and mark the ballot electronically, and then you deliver the you return the physical ballot.
And what's the status of the lawsuit? Where are we? Is it in circuit court at this point?
It's in Dane County Circuit Court. Just got filed. They're looking for accessible voting by August and November, which could be feasible, but we are at the very, very start of this lawsuit.
All right. And what further reporting are you going to be doing on this in the future?
I'll be following the course of the lawsuit. You know, if they get fully electronic voting, we may look at the, you know, security aspect of it. But generally, I'll just be following the course of the lawsuit.
And tell us a little bit about VoteBeat. Who are you and how are you organized?
Yeah, VoteBeat is a nonprofit newsroom. Currently, we have reporters in Arizona, Pennsylvania, Texas, Wisconsin. Then we're hiring in Michigan. Used to have Michigan. And the focus of VoteBeat reporters is to examine the election administration system, how voting works, also voting laws, voting access, election misinformation. We're not focusing on the political aspect. We're focusing on how elections are run in this country, in this state.
All right. We've been speaking with Alexander Schuer, reporter for VoteBeat. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock bus.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report and the Song of the Week coming up right after this.
Oh,
It's 8:23. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Hey, if you've been outside at all, you know where it's peak flower out there. Everything's blooming vociferously. And that brings us to the Outdoor Adventure Report with the spring edition of that. And here's Master Naturalist Paul Nolder.
Good morning, Brother Brian and WORT. Thank you for covering all things nature. Your weekly Outdoor Adventure Report for 4/29 through May 5 is brought to you by Madison Fun, the Friends of Urban Nature, which is a partnership of Parks, Environmental, and Friends groups connecting Madison communities and kids with nature everywhere all year round. Outings are free, welcoming, diverse, fairly accessible, family and kid-friendly, naturalist-guided, educational. Bird and Nature Adventures every week, along with many other outings and events hosted by local nature groups. No registration required unless noted. No special equipment is needed to enjoy the outdoors, to show up and join the fun. This past week was a burst of Earth Week activities. The first Earth Day Every Day celebration with local nature groups at Carver Feed Mill was a big success. Madison Children's Museum hosted a UW Science Alliance Family Fun Night for Earth Week with lots of fun activities and music by Forward Marching Band. Volunteers helped prepare new prairie areas for seeding at Westport Drumlin. Nature lovers, families, and kids took a bird and nature adventure to listen for frogs, and Get Kids Outside hosted wildflower and bird hike at Aldo Leopold Nature Center and Edna Taylor Park. People learned about shifting spring and climate change on a walk at Pheasant Branch and enjoyed beyond backyard birding at a lovely wildflower walk at UW Lakeshore Preserve. Earth Week was capped off with the annual citywide free Madison Bird and Nature Festival with about 500 people indoors at Warner Park Community Recreation Center with nature lovers and kids visiting the live raptor show, about 50 local nature groups with exhibits and fun kids activities, and singing This Land Is Your Land along with Winnet Bird Band with Brother Brian and myself and Ken Longquist. Spring is definitely here with rainwater wildflowers blooming profusely in our woodlands, bright Baltimore orioles singing in flowering trees, and three eagle chicks were sighted in the nest at Warner Park. Coming up this week, we have wonderful spring bird watching opportunities for people of all ages, abilities, and skill levels, including Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance and Friends of Lakeshore Preserve on Tuesday, April 30 at 7:30 at Picnic Point. Go look for spring migrants, including early warblers, vireos, thrushes, orioles, and tanagers. All beautiful. Learn how the habitat serves as a convenience store, or I like to say an interstate pit stop, for migrating birds. And Picnic Point can produce spectacular collections called fallouts of migrant birds who come down for shelter and safety. On Wednesday, May 1, you can join Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance at Cherokee Marsh North Unit at 6 a.m. 24 warbler species are moving through Madison this time of year, and we always have fun tallying up how many we can find. Join us for an early morning walk to look for colorful warblers and other migrants. Madison Parks welcomes public input to help guide and inform public park policies and facility decisions. You are welcome to come to Olbrich Botanical Gardens on Atwood Avenue on Thursday, May 2, anytime between 5:30 and 7:30 to see what's going on and share your thoughts. The UW Arboretum is offering a special bluebirds class on Saturday, May 4th, 1 p.m. at the UW Arboretum Visitor Center to learn about the fascinating lives of bluebirds, their behavior, their reasons for decline, and the successful restoration efforts. Arboretum naturalist instructor and good friend, a goose lover, Sylvia Merrick, created the Arboretum Bluebird Trail in 1988 and has monitored it for more than 30 years. There will be an indoor presentation followed by a walk of the Bluebird Trail. There is a fee of $20. This is a class, and you can register at arboretum.wisc.edu. Please register by April 30. On Saturday, May 4th, Great Wisconsin Birding Teams will be looking for as many bird species as they can find to help raise money for the Natural Resources Foundation to help support Wisconsin bird conservation. See wibirdathon.org to join a team or make a donation to the BBC BIPOC Birding Club team. The paddling Prius peewees and other Great Wisconsin Birdathon teams. On Saturday, May 4th at 2:30, Madison Lakes historian Don Sanford will lead a free family-friendly Tenney Park History Bird and Nature Adventure at meeting at Tenney Park Beach on Old Sherman Avenue. learn about the fascinating history of Lake Mendota, the Ahara Riverway, and Teddy Park, from the Ice Age and Native Americans to early settlers and the present day. On Sunday, May 5 at 1:30, you can enjoy another free fascinating spring birds adventure at Cherokee Marsh North with popular bird guide Chuck Henriksen. Beginning and advanced birders of any age are welcome. The annual Memorial Day Weekend Bird and Nature Camp is coming up May 24 to 27, north of town, about a little over an hour at Lake Lucerne Camp and Retreat Center. There is a fee for staying at the center, but there is no fee for the programs. Nature lovers of all ages, birders, friends, families, and kids are welcome to stay in comfortable cabins with meals served in a dining hall and enjoy daily bird walks and enjoy relaxing nature time over Memorial Day weekend. Contact me, Paul Neldner, PAUL_NOELDNER, at hotmail.com to register and reserve your spot. You don't need to send anything in advance. More May adventures are coming up. There's a senior adventure on May 9 at Warner Park, the month of May, Explore the Creek, Nature Journaling, Signs of Spring, Magic Feathers, Frog and Toad Walk, and the Bird Nature Camp. You can find details at cityofmadison.com parks and tinyurl.com Madison Fun Adventures, and online with Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance and Feminist Bird Club, BIPOC, Get Kids Outside, Friends of Tenny Lapham, Friends of Cherokee, and other groups helping preserve and restore our parks and enjoy nature everywhere in Madison. Join these adventures every week year-round. It's naturally fun.
Behind the mighty controls of the WRT soundboard is John Wilson. And John has the song of the week for us. What's rattling around your musical brain today?
Well, a new album just came out from St. Vincent, which is always fun. Everything she does is a little bit weird, but super listenable and enjoyable. And I got the first single from her new album. The album is called All Born Screaming, and the song is called Broken Man. So I will get that queued up for you.
I'm a king-size killer. I can make your kingdom come. On my feet, I'm an earthquake shaking. So open up my little one. Hey, what are you looking at? Who the hell do you think I am? And what are you looking at? Like you never seen a broken.
It's 8:32. You're listening to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. According to media licensing experts, internet users upload between 4 and 15 billion photos a day to various social media sites. That's a staggering amount of data. And as anyone knows who's seen a prompt asking you if you want to share a memory from a decade ago, much of that data sits on servers forever. Recent research suggests that social media companies are doing more than just storing such images. They're using them to find out more about you and your friends. Kassam Fawaz is the Associate Chair for Research at the University of Wisconsin College of Engineering and Faculty Lead for WIPI, the Wisconsin Privacy and Security Group. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz, Kassam.
Thank you for having us.
Also joining us is engineering PhD candidate and WIPI member Jack West. Welcome, Jack.
Hi.
So what was the start of this research? What made you start to look at what the social media platforms are doing with these images?
Well, it all started about privacy. You know, like how certain vendors tell you what you do stays on the device. And that's supposed to protect our privacy because the data shouldn't go to the cloud, which is amazing because if the data isn't going to the cloud, so whatever they were doing on the cloud, they can do it on the device. If they're doing that on the device, then we can understand what they're doing. And then Jack joined my research group at that time in September 2022. And we started looking into this. 15 months later, Jack discovered lots of things, and I let him talk about it.
So, Jack, tell us exactly what did you do here? I mean, step us through the process that you used to sort of analyze what's happening with some of this data.
That's a great start. So, I'm 26. So I grew up with social media. I had an iPhone in high school. So, and then also Android back and forth. So I was really interested in kind of like exploring what social media apps do. And so what we did, we started from rock bottom. We took the operating system and we read it thoroughly, figured out exactly how it worked. And then we started analyzing apps very thoroughly using our own methods that we came up with in the paper. We found two really interesting machine learning models, both used by Instagram and TikTok. And they were looking at TikTok was looking at age and gender, which was interesting. And then Instagram looked at over 500 different concepts, like Great Wall of China, if you have a beard, if you're wearing sunglasses. So these are things like location, just random objects that you would never expect them to be looking at.
So do we know what these companies are doing with this data? I mean, things, you know, some of this is obvious, right? It's marketing, you know, and they want to know who to niche market to based on your age or, you know, things like that. But things like whether or not you have a beard or sunglasses, what's going on there?
See, that's a question that we're still looking into today because we have some thoughts about it, but we can't, we have no definitive evidence of what they're actually doing with it. They just collect it and they save it somewhere. And that data is never accessed or used, but it's just strange that it's there in the first place.
And so these are AI sort of driven analyses of photos, right?
Yes.
And how does that work? I mean, how do you glean that kind of data from a photographic image?
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
Especially all the buzz about AI.
Yeah.
So they have what's called a machine learning model. It's just like a set of mathematical operations that take an image, basically the set of pixels in that image. It crunches it, and then it maps it to a set of labels. In the case of Instagram, it maps it into a set of 500 labels. And it associates each label with a probability value. How much is it probable that the label is in that photo? In the case of TikTok, we found two labels, the age and the gender. And interestingly, they call it the boy probability.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned that some of this is occurring on the device as opposed to in the cloud. I think most people would assume if I've got a picture on my phone and I haven't directly uploaded it to, say, Instagram, that it's safe. But you're saying they're doing more than that, right?
Oh, yeah. So what Jack found out, and I let him talk a little bit about this. Mm. In Instagram, for example, the moment you select a photo to upload, even if you haven't posted that photo, the moment you select it, it's crunched. All of these labels are extracted from it.
Yeah. And so in TikTok's live all the time. So if you have the, you know how you, like people like to play with filters and face filters and stuff like that with TikTok? During all of that time locally, that machine learning model is looking at your face the entire time.
And what is it learning by that?
So what we saw was just age and gender, and then also if how many faces were in the at the camera at the time. Most interestingly, they also do check for, like, the ages go from 0 all the way up to, like, 99. So they can see children and detect that as well.
And how accurate is this AI analysis? Are there errors that it can introduce, or is it pretty much spot on?
Oh, no, it's not spot on at all. Jack, I'll also let him talk a little bit about that. But we did an extensive study by which we showed TikTok a bunch of photos from people from different demographics and ages. And interestingly, the errors are more as the picture is younger. So for the age range from 0 to 12 or 13, it's way off. It becomes more accurate as you start looking at older people.
Yeah. For example, babies from the ages from 0 to 2 get classified as 13 years old to TikTok on average. Like, there's over thousands of images of toddlers and babies. TikTok thinks that they're 13.
Well, it's sort of comforting in a way to know that they don't have us exactly down. But there's a saying that, you know, if you're getting for something free on the internet, you're the product. And presumably these are intended for some sort of marketing eventually, right? How much of Instagram and TikTok and some of these other social media outlets, how much of their income comes from selling themselves as niche marketers to other advertisers?
Isn't all of their income?
Yeah.
A large chunk. I think the most recent number was Meta made, I think, $38 billion last year or last quarter on advertising revenue, which again is like Instagram, Facebook, all those applications. So we the data that we found, we don't know if it was used for that procedure yet. We're still looking into that. But yeah, I mean, where else could it go, right?
Are you looking to expand this research to other social media platforms?
We are currently doing that. I don't want to spoil anything, I guess, is the right word.
But, okay.
We are looking into a few, and we are also looking into messaging apps as well. So, for example, are end-to-end encryption apps really doing what they say they're doing, that kind of thing?
So if someone is concerned about people analyzing photos on their phone, for example, to try and find out some kind of data about them, is there anything that people can do aside from staying off all social media entirely?
Great question. Again, we're also working on a solution. So because we're so familiar with the operating system, we want to build this tool that allows users to control exactly what that apps can see live. Now, we're still working on that, and we are trying to come up with other solutions as well. So maybe there's other ways we could do it. But we really want to give users control over their data more so than ever before. That's kind of the goal of our lab.
So maybe there'd be some sort of nonprofit app that you could install that would help you manage that kind of usage?
Yeah. We hope to also work with Google, Samsung, like the operating systems directly, so that you know for sure that these apps you have control. Because the problem is, if we provide an app, there's always a way to work around it. But if we work with the operating system, it's harder to work around.
Now, some companies like Google, I mean, presumably they're doing some of the same thing, right? I mean, so do they have a clear, I mean, isn't there a sort of conflict of interest if they're saying on the one hand, yeah, the operating system is secure, but on the other hand, they're also doing data mining and marketing with that?
So with Google, that's very interesting. Because they have full control of their operating system, they can kind of do whatever they want. This is more, I wouldn't say it's against their interests, because they have been under a lot of fire right now compared to iPhone and iOS for privacy. So I think this would really help Android be a more secure platform for user data if they really took advantage of it. And I think in the short term and long term, users would be a lot happier with Android if they took advantage of this.
So, and you mentioned iOS and Apple has sort of escaped some of that. They're seen as more secure. Do we know that that's true?
That's a great question. There's a recent study that was at Popets last year that showed that actually we don't know. iOS does have a lot of anti-privacy practices and a lot of third-party data collection as well. Not nearly as much as Android, but it is there.
The thing is, iOS is not very widely studied in research because it's not open source.
Yes, that too.
So the bar for entry for Android is lower for us.
Okay. So what's next? You mentioned a little bit that you're looking at some other social media platforms. You're looking at trying to devise sort of a prophylactic sort of response to this. What's next for this particular research?
So When apps started using microphone and cameras, operating system reacted by providing users with notices. They can show you this green dot or this orange dot, and you have permissions. What we're going to be advocating through this research is that machine learning or AI is the next frontier. Mm. Whenever machine learning and AI is running on the device, it's crunching your data. Users need to be aware of this, and they need to be they need to have controls. Our study is amongst the first to provide awareness of this phenomenon. then we're going to be providing these controls, these notices, these icons, these notifications, and hopefully at some point operating systems will be adopting some of these things so that when a user is using an app that's crunching their data, they're aware of it.
So tell us a little bit about the Wisconsin Privacy and Security Group. What is your mission?
Well, our mission is to make users or people aware of the privacy problems in everyday devices and systems they use and provide them with solutions. And while we're creating awareness, we create awareness two ways. We create awareness by publishing this research, and you create awareness by coming on radio shows like this one and tell people of privacy problems in everyday devices and systems.
And Jack, you're a PhD candidate. What will you be getting your PhD in, and what do you hope to do with that degree once you get those credentials?
Oh, that's a great question. A lot of family outings ask me the same thing. So I'm doing a PhD in computer science, and I really want to be a professor. I've been wanting to do that for a very long time, and I came to COSM in this lab to do that because COSM's lab was very much exactly what I was looking at to do. Because when you're a PhD student, you should really know what lab you're getting into before you get into it.
All right, we've been speaking with Qasem Fawaz and Jack West of the Wisconsin Privacy and Security Group, a research lab at the University of Wisconsin College of Engineering. Thank you both for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with Atwood Atelier instructor Philip Salamone coming up right after this.
Instagram, the photos of my toes on my OnlyFans, and visuals in these frames look better than the ones that she posted on Facebook. I'm ready when you wanna point that, shoot that, pop that Polaroid, that screw that, shot that, lean that, that only happened in my wildest dreams. We talk about and listen to behind the screens, and I be trying to stream consciousness. Hey, baby, you be trying to stream songs like this. I told you I just want to remember this. I told you I be trying to create memories, but everybody around me wanna check. Only thing that keep me out of the bag, full of that white or that bottle full of that red, is photos on my desk. Only thing that keep me out of my head when I'm in bed is the photos on the wall back when we had it all. So I be trying to keep track of it, catch it in the vanish like a magic trick. Especially when you was on Zans. Hopefully I don't need to understand that. Another stanza, my after my homie managing, making sure that they paying us. I'm just a natural when it comes to picking the plants up, and I'm only 25 G's. Tell that to take a picture for the photo ID.
It's 8:46. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. On Madison Museum of Contemporary Art's semi-annual gallery night, local artists open up their studios to the public, showcasing a wide variety of styles and media of visual arts, including experimental and avant-garde forms. That doesn't mean, though, that the classics are neglected. Atwood Atelier, counterintuitively on Main Street, not Atwood Avenue, provides classes and exhibits focused on classic portraiture and figure drawing. Philip Salamone is an artist and director of the Atwood Atelier, and he joined us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hi.
So what's the appeal of classic portraiture in this sort of postmodern era?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Well, it's always appealed to me, and I would say, what's the appeal? Well, I think just classical, just anything, classical music, classical architecture, classical visual art. I think that there's just a timeless quality because they're just kind of like embracing the fundamentals. And I think that there is, I mean, I think beauty has a is more objective than subjective. And I think that you you just can't escape certain just notions and concepts. And I think a lot of that is hardwired into us. And some of it is cultural, for sure.
Now, that's an interesting idea, that there's an idea, objective standard for beauty out there. Can you elaborate on that a little?
Well, I would say that certainly, well, if you think of, you know, if you think of, like, I don't know, music, for instance, like, everyone has different tastes and styles of music, but everyone likes music that's in key. You know, everyone likes music that, you know, we tend to like a chorus and a verse and a bridge. If you think of visual art, like notions of balance and rhythm in a painting, color, harmony, these are guidelines, not rules. But even if you think of, like, people, as far as, like, just certain indicators of health, indicators of, like, I don't know, fertility, there's a lot of, obviously, people have different preferences, but I think that we have more in common than not.
So tell us a little bit about your own work. Who do you choose as subject matter? And do you have a do you have a certain type of person you're looking for when you decide to paint someone's portrait?
It's all a different variety of reasons. I mean, some people just, for the same reason, like, that we all love different types of art and different types of music and different types of movies, like, they all kind of scratch different itches. You know, sometimes it's like a family member or a friend. Sometimes it's someone who kind of looks interesting. I love, like, just creatives and just, like, artists, musicians, just, like, people who are just, like, interested and curious about the process. I feel like if, you know, you're painting from life, so you're staring at their face, and there's, like, this energy exchange that happens there. And if they're, like, bored or uninterested, it works its way into your work and the whole process. And yeah, so just a variety of, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I would say mostly, you know, friends, family, musician, or friends, family, and artists, etc.
We tend to think of portraits, and particularly painted portraits, as belonging to sort of the upper class and the idea of royalty. And yet, when I look at some of the images that you've produced, there seems to be a lot more common folk there. There's some familiar faces that some WRT folks would recognize, including Alan Ruff and Rob Dees, and, you know, some folks who are, you know, not exactly from upper class. Is that deliberate on your part?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I would love to also paint. I'd like to paint people from all walks of life. I never liked the idea that art is for the elite, because they also have this notion of starving artists. And so I'm like, well, which is it? If it's for the elite, then why are artists starving? I have some thoughts on that, but I think that I just sort of, like, push back against that notion of art being for the elite. I think historically oil painting just involved, like, a whole team of people. Rubens had a workshop of 100 people when you had to, like, grind your own pigments, and, you know, you needed live models, and you needed to just, you know, taxidermy and everything. But I think if you think of other, think about tattooing. Like, there's so many visual art forms that everyone loves that you might not think you love art, but you still love going to the movies, and you still love, like, culinary arts, and you still love, like, I don't know. There's so much fashion, right? There's so much, like, visual arts that appeal to everyone. And I think that there's, like, a vested interest in, like, promoting the idea that art's for the elite, because it, you know, it makes certain people feel better about themselves. But honestly, it just kind of turned me off a lot to, like, a lot of, like, more postmodern than modern art. But you know, I eventually found my people and my training and my kind of path and everything.
So tell us a little bit about Atwood Atelier. What are you trying to do with that organization?
Well, I appreciate you pronouncing it correctly. So atelier is basically, like, it's a French term for, like, a workshop. So it's not specific to oil painting, but the idea is it's sort of like a shout out to the notion of how people used to train with painting, where it was more of like an apprenticeship, and you sort of like worked under a master and you helped them make their paintings, and you eventually kind of figured out their methods and learned how to use your materials and understand nature and visual phenomena and how to see, really, and how to recreate that. And that's like at least 10,000 hours, at least for the work that we're doing. So what I'm trying to do is kind of like I referenced before, I just struggled in art school in like UW here, and I wanted to learn how to draw and paint, you know, well, realistic, beautiful. I know that those are kind of abstract terms, but I did not find that in the training that I had. And so I found a community in New York that was just making really, really amazing paintings, and some teachers and a school. And I spent 3 years in like this classical training where you draw antique plaster casts for a year, and then you move up to painting them in black and white, and then you draw the figure, and then you move up to painting the figure in black and white, and then you paint the figure in color. And there's also like still life and sculpture and anatomy and landscape and this whole kind of like just comprehensive understanding of like a classical kind of sensibilities, basically. And I wanted to bring that to Madison to share what I learned, because I had never heard any of those ideas, and I wanted to kind of bring that back to where I was from. And I knew that there were people that might be interested in that, and I wanted to build a community, not just to teach, but I wanted to learn from other people, because it's really just who's doing anything by themselves.
Philip Salamone, artist, teacher, and director of the Atwood Atelier, thank you so much for joining us. You can see Philip's work and find out more about the Atelier at the 2024 Spring Gallery Night on Friday, May 3rd from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. For details, you can go to mmoca.org. For more information about the Atwood Atelier, go to atwoodatelier.com. Philip, thank you for joining us on The Buzz.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And that wraps up our program. I'd like to thank our guests today, VoteBeat reporter Alexander Schuer, UW Engineering researchers Kasim Fawaz and Jack West, Atwood Atelier instructor Philip Salamone. Thanks to our engineer John Wilson, our receptionist Lori Ranney, and our producer Nicholas Wooten. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We're also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
Find yourself more enraged with every news headline?
Do you have crippling anxiety when you see pictures of starving polar bears on melting icebergs?
Are you shaking your fists at every new threat to bodily autonomy?
If you answered yes to these questions, we have an answer for you. Her Turn, WORT's feminist news, airs every Sunday at 11 a.m., and the Collective is looking for new volunteers to join us.
No previous experience needed, just a commitment to feminist news and a willingness to bring more women's voices to the radio. Call 608-256-2001 and say you want to volunteer on Her Turn.
Turn your anger into action. Turn your anxiety into hopefulness. Turn your discouragement into power. Volunteer with Her Turn right here on WORT Madison and make your woman's voice heard.
Wartstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of 5 Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for 6 with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10-pin alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, 2 for 5 and 5 for 10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
Is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 29th.
Action Weirdos Productions presents This Week in Music History for April 29th. On April 28th, 2023, Joy Aladakun released her fourth studio album, Proof of Life. It's folksy pop from the perspective of a young, black, queer woman raised in Arizona whose parents were Nigerian refugees. Clearly, no shortage of reasons to sing about being ignored, marginalized, even shunned, and on Proof of Life, Joy does. She takes the high road, though, and tells her stories honestly, but with a positive, inspiring, and hopeful outlook. Here's Taking Things for Granted.
Sometimes it feels like everyone's looking at the surface, and it's not happening on purpose, but they're taking things for granted.
Joy's voice is earthy, slightly hoarse, but heartfelt and disarming. She was inspired to learn guitar at 10 after hearing a Tracy Chapman song on the radio. Her lyrics and music blend seamlessly to convey difficult thoughts and feelings in a placatory way to build understanding and connection between humans.
Yeah, we thought it was the end of time, but we're still holding on and we're still trying. Life's always been a little dangerous, but I don't wanna stay the same.
Proof of Life by Joy Oladokun is reflective music with strong folk roots. It reminds us that we as a society still have a long way to go to build a more inclusive world, but that there is indeed proof of life. Also this week, April 29th, 1968, the American tribal love rock musical Hair opens on Broadway. It runs for over 1,700 shows. And happy birthday to Willie Nelson, who turns 91 today. That was This Week, years ago. The most common way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have it.
Under everything, just another human being.